Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm very, very happy, and I think you are all going to be too, because whereas, you know, Bookworm is known for its analysis and its intelligence, today is a show of celebration. I am so thrilled. At the centennial of the artist Winsor McCay, someone has finally, my guest, has finally put together a book of the Little Nemo strips at their actual size as they originally appeared in the Herald. And I have here the editor of this collection, Peter Maraska, in the studio with me, and Art Spiegelman on the telephone from his studio in New York. Art is a longtime admirer, both of Peter Maraska and of Little Nemo. And, you know, Art is, as well, one of my favorite people, really, in the world. And Little Nemo is my favorite comic strip. So this confluence can only bode well. I want you all to take out a pencil and a piece of paper, because this is going to be one of those shows where you're going to want the book and you're going to have to know how to go about getting it, because it will disappear if you're not prompt. Okay, let's begin. Who is Winsor McCay, Peter?
Winsor McCay is, I think he's sort of the Renaissance man of popular culture. Around the turn of the century, he began drawing for drawing posters for sideshows and carnivals, and got involved in drawing little comic strips. Sort of a person drew every moment he was awake since he was a child. And he then worked in Cincinnati on his very first comic strip, had the good fortune to be hired into New York to draw a comic strip there, and in 1905 created what many people feel is the world's greatest comic strip, Little Nemo in Slumberland. And that was just 100 years ago, October.
Now, Art, how did you discover Little Nemo?
Actually, from the man who rescued most of this artwork from total oblivion, a guy named Woody Gelman, who ran a bubblegum company in New York, who I ended up speaking with when I was 14 or 15 before my voice changed, and working for when I was 18. And he remembered me from our meeting at 15 because I seemed to be as interested in old newspaper comics and things like that as he was. And he was one of the great collectors at a time when I guess it was like collecting bottle caps or something. It wasn't a category. But he put together a vast and amazing collection of things. And I would spend time dozing off in his basement when invited to stay there and just reading old papers. And he had two complete runs of Little Nemo and a number of the actual pieces of artwork that he got under very bizarre circumstances, because it was what had inspired him to want to be a cartoonist. And he indeed worked for the Fleischer Animation Studios for a long time before he got relegated to the depths of Brooklyn and a bubblegum company.
Now, me, I found Little Nemo because, you know, Art Spiegelman had introduced me to Chris Ware's Jimmy Corrigan, The Smartest Boy in the World. And from that point, having already admired Art Spiegelman's Mouse, I regarded anything that came as a recommendation from Art to be, you know, well, the absolute truth. And back then, there was only a Little Nemo that was pretty complete, published by Fantagraphics. But that was around two-thirds of the size of this, maybe even less. What are the dimensions of this book, Peter?
This book is 16 by 21 inches, which is a little bit smaller than an actual newspaper page of the time, but they had very wide margins and logos and so forth. But within the panels, it is exactly the size of the original strips.
Well, even as coffee table books go, it's the largest book I've ever
seen. Well, it's actually more a living room floor book, I think,
absolutely,
than a coffee table book.
Yes, because when you open the book, in fact, that the width is doubled. So it's actually...
Yes, people say to me, how in the world am I going to, where am I going to put this thing? I don't have a bookshelf. I say, no, the proper way to store this is slid under your living room sofa, and every Sunday morning you slide it out and on the carpet.
Now, one of the privileges I have as a bookworm is I get to talk to people on the air and off. And so Art telling me about this new edition of Little Nemo in Slumberland, So Many Splendid Sundays, edited by Peter Maruska. Of course, we know what kind of culture we're living in. No one would publish this. And so Peter Maruska did it himself, starting a brand new press called Sunday Press. And Art explained to me something that I absolutely loved, that the pictures at their larger size, you would expect to be more intimidating, but he found them more human. Can you tell me about that, Art?
Well, the thing about McKay is he's a masterful, masterful draftsman. Among other people that he influenced, I guess, is Hal Foster's Prince Valiant, but it's a much more lively and alive work. But it has a kind of draftsmanship that, for somebody as clumsy as me, is very intimidating. And seeing it at its intended scale, smaller than the original drawings, but the intended scale, one can see that it's done by an incredibly skilled human as opposed to some strange pre-computer machine that could make these dizzying perspectives happen. And it's got a line. You can feel the line. You can hear the pen scratch somewhere in there, you know? And things that weren't at all available to me at the smaller size, like the words, for example. He didn't letter to accommodate a book that was formerly considered a large size Little Nemo book that was a little over half the size of what it was intended to be printed at. So the assumption was, well, there's not much to read in there. And looking at it now, well, you know, he's got some very interesting things happening with the language, and it's very available, and the handmadeness of the handwriting, even though he's a consummate circus show card letterer, his balloons are written in a kind of very short of clumsy, but looking like they're just sort of written in.
Yeah, and a lot of people have faulted him for that. It's interesting.
And I thought it wasn't much until I saw it as full size, and then I realized what a choice that was, what an interesting choice, because it's perfectly readable and comfortable at its full scale. But what's really interesting is it's trying to... this is, remember, in the first 10 years at the most of the invention of the comics, as the beginnings of these comic supplements. And he's trying to understand what a speech balloon is. So a speech balloon is a piece of visual information that's not visual. It's the audio part before there were sound films. The visuals have a lot to do with cinema. He was also a pioneer of animation, as I think Peter was starting to get toward when he called him a Renaissance man. He's one of the godfathers of the animated cartoon, and it shows in his panel-to-panel exposition. But he's trying to understand what these words are in the balloons, and they're meant to be visible and invisible so they can kind of talk to you. And they sit in a different plane than the rest of the picture. And it's actually very sweet.
Well, to put people into the picture, Little Nemo is a little boy who, going to sleep, inevitably ends in Slumberland. In fact, he's summoned there. The king, Morpheus, has sent an oomp to get him. And by the end of the frame, his experiences in Slumberland are either so frightening or so ecstatic that he is being rattled in his bedclothes and waking up to a parent who is either concerned that he's not going to wake up or is splashing him with water to get him awake because it's time for the day. But any page you turn to, I just turn to one. On the top of this page are a series of clowns. They're in red and white stripes, sometimes polka dots. The stripes look like the way jail cons used to look in movies, you know, those very bright stripes. And before long, they're hauling these big tuba-like instruments. So the stripes and the tuba, and then pretty soon there is a confusion of tubas, the tubas becoming like spaghetti, joining with the stripes, and then by the last big panel, the tubas all arrayed around the central hornblower look like an array like the nucleus and whorls of electrons around the atom. On the very next page, eggs are opening up, bursting open. There are rabbits inside them, and the princess, Cinderella-like, is going to turn those burst shells into carriages, the way a pumpkin once was in another fairy tale, and the rabbits are going to be drawing the carriage.
Part of it is there's the content, and the content is this beautiful, dreamy thing with images that are really evocative, beds that walk, things distorting like funhouse mirrors, something very much inspired by the Chicago Exposition of 1893 and the Coney Island that McKay lived near. But it's really hard to even give a sense of the content, let alone what's actually happening on the page, where it's so engaged with the tools of making itself that in spite of its great, I forgive him his great drawing, McKay, because he's also like really an amazing visual thinker. You
know? And it's interesting how much he loves chaos for someone who is who does such you know, really beautifully accurate architectural lines and drawings, but everything always seems to descend into complete madness, both in the storyline and in the art itself.
Yeah, there's a real dreamlike anxiety that runs through this thing. And the other thing I wanted to mention is just like, it's only really fully visible since that time that I used to spend in Woody Gelman's basement. It's only really visible in this edition because it's beautifully remastered, but also the color that was originally there was done by craftsmen who was voraciously interested in what they could do with these new color printing processes, as McKay was. So they really went the distance, and they went, ooh, we can move this from the black plate to a blue plate, and then we can fade this color here. And so the color has a sumptuousness that is born of great craftsmen working at the height of their craft.
Well, and it was a thrill for them. Yeah, it was a thrill for them at the time, too, because they knew that they were inventing this, mm-hmm. that this this whole process was only a few years old.
Yeah, the thrill of invention is what courses through the whole work.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW, and I'm talking with Peter Maresca and Art Spiegelman about Winsor McKay's Little Nemo in Slumberland, Splendid Sundays, 1905 to 1910, published by Sunday Press. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Peter Maresca and Art Spiegelman about Winsor McKay's Little Nemo in Slumberland. Now, I want you to tell my listening audience, first off, how to get to your website.
It's www.sundaypressbooks.com, and there's a lot of images from the book. And as we have time to do so, I'm going to throw up some more images as well and try and get a little more information about McKay and about what it actually took to put this book together.
Well, you've done a first edition of the book of only 5,000 copies, many of which are now, it's becoming the Tickle Me Elmo of the season. can they order at the website?
Yes, we're going to try and keep as many. Well, it's sort of a delicate balance. I want to keep available as much as possible from the website, but I also really want to get these books out into a lot of the small independent stores that are anxious to carry them. And I think it's really important for people, even if they feel they can't afford the price, is to have a chance where there's a place to look and go see these. I'd also love to get them into libraries and in libraries and schools.
Well, people who are wondering about that, they should be told that it's $120 and it's and even though this is going to sound like an infomercial, it's a bargain.
Well, that's what Art told me immediately, that this was, well, I think it is. It's a book of the year. I'll tell you why, in addition to all this stuff that collectors love to hear, it's that if palaces with their miraculous crenellated turrets, if stalagmites and stalactites, if extraordinary chorus cuties arranged in kaleidoscopic patterns, if all of these didn't already exist, Winsor McCay would have invented them. And, you know, as you turn the pages, suddenly you're at a window and a huge giant is looking in at the diminished figures, all of them in football field array. You cannot imagine how much this is not only about dream and the beauty of created image, but as Art was saying to me, about scale. Can you say more about that, Art?
Yeah, I think what blew me away with this thing is I really thought I knew Nemo before, and I had spent some time with these Sunday pages, but they were fragile. I wasn't able to engage in it as with a book where you just dive in. And here, it became really apparent that of all the works that needed to be printed in its full dimension, it was this one, because what was exciting to McKay was the scale. The strip is about giant creatures climbing New York City buildings. It's about diminutive kids wandering around bowls of fruit. It's about a bed that grows legs and walks from a suburban home into downtown, gets tangled in a church steeple, and tumbles Nemo back out of bed. It's all about these stretches and squattings and juxtapositions of different sized elements that are only really visible when one is allowed to take its measure, and that's what this book is finally offering. So what it does for me is it's as if so there's this artist, and insofar as in my field there are artists who have been given the high sign, McKay is one of them. He had a show in the 60s at the Metropolitan Museum of Art when comics were really barely even considered pop art. And yet, for all of the lip service paid to him, one's never been able to see it. So it's as if somebody actually discovered an unknown artist or, well, I don't know what the right analogs are. I keep trying to find them. It's as if, let's say, Chaplin or Keaton only existed in scratchy films that were shown at the wrong speed on television with especially grating jazz music on a short loop behind it, and that was all one could know of Chaplin.
Or a QuickTime movie.
Right, the QuickTime version on the screen. And then you're told that, like, Keaton is a master and has Beckett-like qualities, or whatever it is that you end up hearing about it. It's unbelievable until you actually are exposed to it. And here, for the first time, this work is made available. And there's a hot new kid on the block. He draws really well, and, you know, he did the strip 100 years ago.
Well, in fact, at the show at both the Armand Hammer Museum in Los Angeles and the Museum of Contemporary Art, there's a huge section of work by Winsor McCay because, you know, he stands in the history of comic books as one of the great forebears, as one of the originators of how to think about the form of the strip. Art also taught me how to look at another, which was always beautiful enough in that it detailed the approach of an elephant. Now, he began by pointing out to me that this strip divided into long rectangles going down the page is hardly the shape for an elephant. And at the bottom of each of these rectangles, Nemo and the princess are watching the elephant get nearer and nearer. Well, you take it, Art.
Okay. So it's these long vertical panels, and the elephant is coming down a flight of steps toward the bottom of each panel where there's Nemo and the princess. And the elephant comes forward by the third panel. In the fourth panel, it lowers its trunk to lift them up. In the last panel, it has them lifted up, but where in that bottom part of the other panels was is the traditional, it's only a dream, wake up, don't sleep so much, blah, blah, kind of panel. But what's really kind of interesting to me is this princess in her little ballerina dress that's pink becomes the towering mother sitting on the bed with little Nemo in the last panel in her pink nightdress.
Mm-hmm.
And it hints at something very interesting to me in both McKay and Georges Méliès, who I find has a lot in common with him somehow, the inventor of the trick film, the beginnings of what have become the special effects industry of Hollywood. So Georges Méliès' films also, on the one hand, seem kind of innocent, and on the other hand, have a weird psychosexual subtext that, in McKay's case, just comes with the subject of dreams.
And even more basic than that was the anxiety that Nemo's feeling in this particular page. And as the elephant comes closer and closer and fills and expands inside the frame, Nemo's anxiety begins to grow. And of course, as you say, the princess is playing the motherly role, calming him down bit by bit. Then at the final panel, when all you really see is the front of the trunk and the mouth of the elephant, Nemo is completely petrified. And
I don't like this one little bit. No.
That's one of those things that he's almost always saying. What's sort of funny about Slumberland is whether it's Flip or Nemo or the captain, they don't like being there. It's sort of like here they are being offered anything that the imagination can come up with, and the characters are fighting to escape. It's kind of a strange tension.
They want to get back to that nice little box that's safe, their little apartment.
Well, I think like real dreams, it often goes both ways, where most of it, particularly the first couple of months of the strip, it really is nightmarish and frightening. But as it moves along, there are parts that are so wondrous and delightful that Nemo wishes he didn't wake up.
Well, there's also this thing of, in the course of the strip, Nemo seems to grow up a bit, not in size, but in mastery of his situation. He's not as passively afraid of everything.
Right.
He becomes more princely at a certain point.
Well, one of the things that I love is that inevitably, when you have a man who's thinking, how do I make this happen? Well, how do I clarify what are the legs of this widely growing bed from the edges of the frame? In fact, it's useful for those legs to become entangled with the frame. Well, as we'd expect with this kind of self-consciousness, eventually there are strips in which characters go to an exhibition where they see pictures of the princess, Morpheus, Flip. This on a page, facing a page in which they've looked at themselves in funhouse mirrors,
right,
and suddenly they're stretched and extended. You don't see more deeply into the characters in Nemo as they go along, but you come to know their every surface.
And it's interesting, this page in particular, I think Art can identify with, because the page you're speaking of that follows the funhouse mirror is actually a caricature of a different sort, and it's a play on the funny Valentines that were popular in that period. I thought Art Spiegelman had invented those back in the 60s, but as it turns out, even around the turn of the century, there were satiric Valentine cards that would actually make fun of people and make fun of situations. And in this case, they took the real characters of Slumberland and made up silly, quasi-insulting poetry about them. And the characters are there looking through these images in the large book and getting a real kick out of it.
It's interesting because they never really express great horror at what they see. There's a kind of genial acceptance about looking at an image, whereas reality, that is scary. It has thorns and prickles like the cactuses. I love the next page where we've got what could be better in a children's dream than what looks like a whole series of chutes and ladders and, what are they called, the banisters to slide down. And eventually I think that what McCabe is about is looking for new shapes, this time an arc, to bring across the frames, to link to one another so that the eye is always being taught how to move more crazily. It's like a line of beauty that the eye is moving across so that you see the whole picture before you see the individual frame. It stuns you, and then you look at the detail.
Well, this is a page that creates a kind of incredible vertigo because it's part of a sequence called, in my mind, Befuddle Hall.
Yes.
In which they've entered into a topsy-turvy palace, and the page you're looking at, they're basically standing on the ceiling and on the walls. There's no north and south anymore. At the bottom panel, they're kind of hanging on to the bottom of a table, which is on the ceiling. The ceiling, which is the floor, is where Nemo gets to fall out of bed, or to the roof, depending on how far into his dream he still is. So there's just this kind of swirl. I think this has a lot to do with Coney Island.
Particularly that last panel with the jets of air coming out of the ground and the doors flipping each way. And
that's right. Sendak mentions that he lived near Coney Island, right, near Luna Park and mm-hmm. Steeplechase.
Yeah, and it definitely informs the sensibility here. There are all these things I'd like to know about McKay. I'd like to know how much he knew about Muybridge, the guy who did the photographs of an animal in motion and whatever, because it seems like really important to him. I'm curious to know if he knew Georges Méliès' films. He's kind of a contemporary. I would suspect he did, but can't be sure. And the one that you can't help but wonder, aside from like back in the 60s when I just wondered what drugs he took, I at this point just sort of like wonder whether he was even aware of Sigmund Freud.
Well, it's interesting that you asked that, Art, because it is worth bringing up that the people at Harry and Abrams, who did not put out this extraordinary life-sized version of Little Nemo.
They did think it was a nice idea, though.
Yes.
They wanted one if you did it.
Did reissue The Life of Winsor McKay, Winsor McKay, His Life and Art, by John Kanemaker, in time for the centennial, just to mention that it is out there, and it is the biography of Winsor McKay, if you start to become interested. But always we want to begin with the art, and in that case, the best place to begin is with this book, edited by my guest, Peter Maresca, Little Nemo in Slumberland, So Many Splendid Sundays. I want to thank you, Peter and Art, for joining me to celebrate this book. There's nothing else, really, to be done with it other than to whoop for joy, but I hope you've enjoyed our whoops.
Great. It's been splendid.
Thanks a lot.
But really, check out the website. Give it to us one more time.
It's www.sundaypressbooks.com.
Thank you both for joining me. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com. Keyword Bookworm. Copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183. Pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold, and books, 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 books can be funny too. Books make you laugh and sing, books tell you everything, they're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.